Bibles open to Proverbs chapter 2, and we are in verse 7, looking at this. I'll take this back off. This is the third component in a very vital and critical section that comprises our exhortation, which we have come to appreciate is just as critical as the doctrine itself, to the son's commitment to the effectual working of what he learns. This is what a father would do with his son just prior to beginning his formal education in earnest and beginning, as we will know, to teach him and instruct him in godly wisdom decision-making skills. That is to go back with his son and make sure by exhorting him to those five probing questions that he probed his heart with in Romans chapter 8, that all that godly commitment, attitude, enthusiasm, and desire for wanting this education as badly as the father wants to give it to him, that they're both on that same level and ready to open the book and ready to start with lesson one. And so these exhortations are critical. And as I have seen in you, it's, you know, been a while maybe since you've revisited those five probing questions, thought about them, and it's taken a little prying to get some of these things back up into your thinking. So I think it's very profitable that we do this. And we've gone through two of them now. The third one here, he is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. My understanding matches the third probing question of Romans 8:33, who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? And in our last lesson, we talked about a recap of what that question is about. It has to do with you being your own worst enemy. In the order in which God gives our enemies, three different questions concerning them, two about us, one about Satan, they're in an order in which they are the most common to the least common, the most troublesome to the, well, they're all troublesome, but the one that is more commonly troublesome to the one that is less commonly troublesome. And so the most common, most often dealt with enemy and that you will ever face in your sonship life is the issue of sin still being in your members, of either outright disobedience and sinfulness occurring in your life, or taking the curriculum that you're learning from your father and using it in a sinful manner, any of which, or all of which, could cause you to feel like or assume that it's a fatal blow to your sonship life and that you've lost your inheritance with your father and you might as well quit. And your father says, no, I justified you. Just as secure as you are in your eternal life, that's how secure you are in your being a member of my family and having an heir, being my heir and having an inheritance as an heir of God. So you will gain that inheritance of the kingdom. You may not have any part of its running, but you will inherit the kingdom, the part of the kingdom that has to do with the creature. Now, once we've gone through that and realized that God has, you know, joyfully, he has designed in advance for our failures, and he's provided in the curriculum for all of that. You know, he's already provided even before we got to sonship for this one. The first 13 verses of Romans 8 give you the mechanical means by which you deal with personal sin in your life. So when it comes to the kind of post-doctrine exhortation to that, you look back and you say, oh yeah, he's a buckler to them that walketh uprightly. So this, the third probing question and its godly remedy matches up with Romans or with Proverbs 2:7b, and that's because here is the first time that you're told in these exhortations about an enemy that you're going to face in which an implement of war is going to be utilized, and it's called a buckler. And warfare is going to take place with this enemy that we're going to face. It's a stiff opposition. But it says God is, it says he's a buckler to them that walk uprightly. And here's where you're going to now begin to gain an appreciation for why it says buckler and not shield. That the expression of a buckler is one that we don't normally ever think about, because we don't really think about anything buckle-wise except what's on our belt. And actually, I think a belt buckle actually comes from that. I think the buckler is from an old French root or something like that, but stemming out of that is even belt buckles. But what I want you to begin to appreciate, and I don't have pictures or anything for this, but first of all, it doesn't say he is a shield to them that walk uprightly. And if you've got a Bible that's a study type Bible, you may see in a center column or a marginal reference or a footnote that they'll put to the word buckler, and it'll say it's a shield. Unfortunately, I checked this out, and every other modern English translation that I know of changes the word buckler in Proverbs 2:7 to the word shield. By doing so, they just destroyed the concept. And you'll get some goofy footnote that says, a buckler is just another way of saying shield. No, it is not. That's one of the first things you've got to realize when you're dealing with this. A buckler is a kind of a shield, but buckler and shield do not mean the same thing. That is, you cannot say that a buckler is just another fanciful way of saying the word shield. Let me prove this to you for a moment. If you get a good concordance, or you've got a search engine with your Bible software or something, you can find all these verses on your own. There's numerous passages in God's Word where both buckler and shield are used together. But I want to just show you one instance so you'll at least have one. Come over to the 91st Psalm. Well, actually, come back to the 91st Psalm. This is in the section of Psalms, the book of Psalms, the fourth book of Psalms, in which you're dealing and surrounding the core issue of the king and his kingdom, of the fourth mandate of the Davidic covenant. And let me just start at verse 1 here. And I want you to see how David, or the psalmist rather, is extolling God for his power and his strength of what he has done. And he says in verse 1, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." It's a very famous and familiar verse with a lot of Christians. "I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence." Look at verse 4. "He shall cover thee with His feathers, and under His wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler." Whoops. Well, I should have checked it out on some of the other English versions, how they handle that. Do they say shield and shield? I don't think so. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. By the way, that's very, very parallel to what this is talking about as well. But anyway, because there's going to come a time in which you're going to need a shield. But with this enemy, you don't need a shield. With this enemy, you have to have a buckler. In fact, to do with this enemy of you yourself and sin in your members, to deal with it with a shield, you're never going to win. But to deal with it with a buckler, that's the way it's designed for you to win and do what's supposed to be done. We'll come back to Proverbs and we'll see how that happens. All right. So we know that the expression buckler and shield don't mean the same thing. God doesn't deal with them that way at all. A buckler is actually a species of a shield. It's a particular kind of a shield. But it's not designed to do what a full body shield does. And that's what a shield is all about, a full body shield. If you ever get to see a picture of a rendering of a Roman soldier, whether he was praetorian or just a plebe or whatever he is, when they would go into battle, and sometimes you'll see these on some pretty well researched movies, I can't remember, I think that movie Gladiator had that, where they'd have the full body shield that would be nearly as long as their body, and they could drop it down on the ground, have it hit the ground, and all they had to do is just crunch down, and they could be totally, their whole body would be shielded. And then oftentimes they would use these things in what they called a tortoise shell maneuver, where they would, if they were being hit with archers, they would all get together in a square and they would hold them up and they'd get down and they'd be totally covered by them. So a soldier would carry that shield, but he knew, you know, oftentimes we get in our minds that the only weaponry that soldiers really used well were swords and knives and spears. But the fact of the matter is a shield could be used even as a weapon itself, but mostly it was a defensive mechanism. And the body shield was just that. It was designed to get your entire body behind it. A full body shield's primarily designed to come along and hide, get your body behind it, and deflect anything that comes your way. Now, there's going to come a time in your sonship life in which that full body shield is going to be necessary, especially in level 2 when you start to undergo the sufferings of Christ and you start now dealing much more personally with the adversary and with his cohorts. And Paul will come along and he'll talk about in Ephesians 6 that you put on the whole armor of God there, and one of those pieces is the shield of faith. That's that full body shield, which is what you hide behind when those fiery darts of the wicked start coming your way, or when the arrows come at you, or a shield you could hide behind when they would times they would fight you with slings, and some of the what do they call those things, trebuchets or the catapults that they would use. Sometimes they wouldn't just throw one big rock with them. They'd throw a whole bunch of smaller rocks. Rocks that could kill you, but kill a lot of people. It's what came to be in the Civil War called grape shot. Grape shot is like a canister that has miniature-sized cannonballs in them, and it acts as kind of a shotgun when it goes out. It just sprays the battlefield with these large pieces. Well, they had the same type of thing, and the shield, the body shield, could be utilized that way against those things that were coming your way from a standing army. But the buckler isn't like that. Unlike the shield, and this is where you start making some connections, why he says he is a buckler to them that walketh uprightly, when the issue is that some charge could be laid to me because of a sinful act I've done, that I've stupidly and foolishly yielded to the sin in my members, and it has caused me to realize I'm doing battle with myself. I've become my enemy to the success of my sonship life. Well, he is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. Unlike the shield, a buckler is only used in hand-to-hand combat, sometimes called arm-in-arm combat, arm-to-arm, hand-to-hand, arm-to-arm combat. It's used in what's called close-in fighting. And it's an ingeniously designed piece of armament for that soldier because of what it allows him to do. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But first and foremost, the buckler is used in hand-to-hand combat. The buckler is the soldier's weapon against another individual soldier. That's what it's used for. It is a soldier's weapon to be used against another individual soldier. Beginning to see something here? You're going up. You're not going up against a whole bunch of enemies here. You're going up against one enemy, yourself. The buckler is designed to be used against one individual other soldier. In other words, the buckler is to be used against another person just like the soldier himself. He's a soldier. And the buckler is designed to be used against another soldier just like himself. And it's almost like you now have yourself in two different forms, your enemy and you. And here's another critical aspect about a buckler. A buckler, unlike a shield, is a species of a shield or weapon that the soldier never, ever puts down. The buckler is actually strapped onto him. He doesn't hold it in his hand. It's strapped to his arm. Being a righty, I'll talk about it that way. I'm not a southpaw. So being a righty, it would be strapped to my left arm. But I don't have, it's not something I have to hold on to. So therefore, I never put it down. It's never, ever put down. In fact, it's usually tied onto the arm, and it can't come off. He can't lose it. I mean, the only way it could is if his arm was lopped off, but then you're pretty much out of the fight. But it's strapped to his arm. It can't come off. He can't lose it. He can take his body shield, and in some cases, it was perfectly right to do so. He would shed it. He would put that down. There's times you can't exactly, with some of those body shields, you can't charge an enemy and get in close with him with that thing. You discard that on the battlefield. So he can lay down the body shield. In fact, once you go through the artillery barrage of the arrows and the slings are done, the soldier usually drops his body shield. And then he charges the other soldiers with his sword in his right hand and his buckler, which is a kind of a shield strapped to his left arm. And the buckler is attached to that arm and it never comes off. And what I'm saying in all this is that this buckler is the kind of terminology whereby you would be utilizing it to describe a defensive, protective type of armament, which is what a buckler was for. It was a defensive mechanism, a geniusly designed one, that was a piece of his armament that he should never, ever drop. He cannot be without it. And it was designed, listen, when you're dealing with hand-to-hand combat, that is your closest enemy. The buckler was designed to be a defensive type piece of armament to deal with your constant and closest opponent. When you would charge into hand-to-hand combat, you may have a lot of other things going on right around you, but the only guy you're serious about is the guy right in front of you who's fighting you. Your closest, constant opponent. And once you dispatch him, you turn to the next constant, closest opponent, and you dispatch him. It's just like when, in the Civil War, when Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, took his main brigade down Little Round Top in that textbook maneuver in which he won the day there, received the Medal of Honor for it. At one point, they were in hand-to-hand combat, and while all this horror was going on around him, the only thing he was concerned with was his nearest, closest, constant opponent, which happened to be a Southern colonel who stuck his Navy six, his six shooter, his revolver right in his face, pointed right at his nose and went like that and fired it, and he was out of rounds and went click. And the colonel just flipped it over and handed it to him and said, "I surrender." I don't know how many years that'd take off of you, but it'd take a few off of me. That's the one you're concerned with, is your nearest, constant, closest opponent. That's what the buckler was made for. That's what it was designed for, just like in hand-to-hand, arm-to-arm combat. And that's exactly what you're dealing with when you're dealing with yourself. There's nobody closer to you. There's nobody more constant to you. And when it comes to enemies, you're not going to have a closer, more constant enemy than yourself, than that old sin in your members. That's your closest constant opponent. And that's why God comes along and says, I'll be a buckler. I'm going to be that thing that's strapped on your arm. And the truth is, folks, the adversary himself can't be described like that with you and me. He may be in some ways our most determined opponent, but he is not always close. And he's not always there, but sin in your members is. It's always there. I know that, you know, I'm a list guy. I like formulating lists in my mind. My favorite ball players, my favorite teams, my favorite songs. We all like lists of things. Near the top of the list of things that I am going to be so looking forward to is to finally receive a body that doesn't have sin in its members. Because as much as I enjoy sinning, and I enjoy some sins immensely, I've come to recognize the ruin that it is to my sonship life. And I fall back on time and time again my father's techniques of dealing with it. And I see improvement. I see enormous improvement. But I still see things that have deep wheel tracks that need to be dealt with and will be dealt with as the curriculum deals with them later on. But I so look forward to not having sin in my members anymore. Maybe that's wrong, because my attitude probably should be, why, it's a great opportunity for God's Word to demonstrate how powerful grace is. I know that that's what my attitude should be, but there's still part of me that I just long for the day when that thing's gone and it doesn't talk trash to me anymore. But for now, we can put on display the power of God's Word, and this buckler issue is a marvelous provision. But And sin is always going to be there. It's always going to be close. And that's why the buckler term is used in connection with this issue. And the kind of opposition that sin in our members always rears its ugly head to, in opposition to us, is when we walk uprightly. That's when it's going to rear its ugly head the most. When we're walking uprightly. And this is why it was good to go over some of the things we did with the probing question. Because when we're walking after the Spirit, that's the time when the flesh, as we were told, is going to lust against the Spirit and the Spirit against the flesh, to kind of remind you of what you were taught back there in Romans 6:1-8:13, And then there's some other things that are said along those lines over in the book of Galatians. But that's when it's going to really rear its ugly head, is when we're walking after the Spirit, because it wants us walking after the flesh. We're spiritually minded, it wants us to be carnally minded. Therefore, when it says in Proverbs 2:7b, He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly, our Father's dealing with what He has built, and having you think about what He's built into the curriculum that's designed to be able to deal with sin in our members. Our most constant, closest, and most frequent opponent, ourselves. And our Father has designed into the curriculum and built into it the means by which we can deal with sin in our members. And we've been taught a great deal about it already in Romans 8:1-13. And especially, it's important when we do fail. And we all will in this area, because none of us are going to live sinlessly perfect lives. When we do yield to the opposition of the lust of our flesh, And when we stop walking uprightly, and there's particular information that God has built into the curriculum, some of it, like I said, some great aspects of it you've already covered, but you haven't covered it all yet. As I said, there are certain aspects of the affections of our lust that get dealt with later on. So don't be looking as you're approaching Romans 12, 1 and 2 and presenting your body a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, that you are supposed to have come to the point where you've mastered sin in your life so well that you will never sin again from this point forward. That's not what is expected, and that's not what is being asked of you there. But you should now have a great understanding of what it means to present yourself a living sacrifice, and what it means, what holy is about, sanctification-wise, and what a son and a daughter is expected to understand sanctification-wise up to this point. God never expects something ahead of where you are. So don't superimpose that you're supposed to be somewhere where you're not. But you are supposed to understand some things about how to deal with sin in your members. And God's going to, since He's a buckler to them that walk uprightly, He's going to continue providing information, because there's things, quite frankly, that, how do I want to put this? I love running myself into a wall and thinking, oh, I maybe not should say this right now. There's things in your life right now that you have never even been tempted to do and seen it as a possible yielding of your members to the lusts of your flesh that will occur to you down the road in sonship, because they're just some things that you don't even consider as a sinful issue right now, or a disobedient issue. You know what I mean? That maybe I shouldn't even have gone there. But that's one of the reasons why you find more and more information throughout the curriculum that takes that up, where that buckler issue comes into effect. And when we would decide to stop walking uprightly, you notice it doesn't say He is a buckler to them that don't sin. He says He's a buckler to them that walk uprightly. And so that's the issue of us understanding the way and the paths of walking uprightly, and some of those things we are yet to discover that build upon that, the whole edification building process. So particularly, God has designed information into the curriculum that He wants us to think about, and He wants us to operate upon when this kind of opposition gets the best of us, when sin has become an issue, when we have stupidly yielded our members to some sinful act, and when we've stopped walking uprightly. And He wants us to utilize and operate upon this kind of thing when it's gotten the best of us, when that enemy that ourselves has become, which is designed to allow us to recover. That's what a buckler was for. A buckler was designed for the soldier to recover. That's what it was designed for. It was designed to recover ourselves and go on. It's kind of like, okay, imagine yourself as a soldier. For some of you, that's not going to be hard. For others, it's going to be a real stretch. But if you imagine yourself as a soldier, one of the reasons why the Roman legions were so successful was not only because of great ingenious planning and strategy and tactics, but they had some of the most cutting-edge innovations when it came to warfare armament. The Machaira itself was an ingenious development. Before then, the whole concept of warfare was like Conan the Barbarian. You know, it's like whose sword is the biggest. Braveheart. You know, they got these giant broadswords, two hand jobs, and they're whipping them all around and all this kind of thing. Look how mean I am! I've got a big sword. I'm going to cut you to pieces. Well, the Romans, man, they understood real quick that I could take a little 5 foot nothing guy and kill that guy so fast. And it's because he has to take all this energy to get this sword cranked back, and when he does, he opens his entire rib cage up. And they developed a Machaira, about an 18-inch sword with a sharp point, two very razor-sharp edges on it. And it was designed to get up underneath and come up underneath a guy and just slip that thing in between the rib cage, pierce his lungs and heart, slip it out, and he's killed a giant, brought him right down. And they're close in, hand-to-hand fighting was ingenious. And one of the cutting-edge things they had developed was this buckler concept. They knew in advance that they were going to get knocked down. Nobody is going to train a soldier and say, well, we're just going to train you to keep advancing forward. No, you know that because of the mess that war becomes, the first tragedy of war is your battle plan. It goes out the window about 30 seconds after it begins. In fact, there's a whole big planning process that I won't get into right now for what they call the first 30 seconds of engagement. And that's why you often hear like a Medal of Honor recipient stand up and say, what the enemy didn't plan on was that we survived the initial 30 seconds. That probably goes right over your head. But there's a whole plan involved in the first 30 seconds. Well, anyway, the Romans understood and the Greeks understood that their soldiers were going to get knocked down. That's part of combat. So they planned and designed for them to get back up. That's what the buckler's for. The buckler was designed for recovery when you're knocked down on the battlefield. And if you think of yourself as a soldier there with your buckler strapped onto your arm, you get knocked down, well, what do you do now? I mean, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Every soldier's going to get knocked down. Well, the buckler actually gives you the capacity to get back up again and get in the fight. That's why this isn't a shield. The shield wasn't designed for that. The buckler was designed to be strapped onto your arm, and it was designed so that when you got knocked down, there was a technique in which you would be able to get back up and get into the fight. That's one of the most important reasons for its design and for its purpose, was to give that soldier a chance and give him the capacity to get back up again. It's recognized, as I said, the soldier's going to get knocked down in combat, but this piece of his armament allowed for him to put it to use in order to regain his footing, to stand back up and get back into the fight. It's an ingenious implement of war. I'll describe it a little further in a moment. But the proper use of the buckler was not to hold it in your hand, but to have it actually, as I said, laced with these leather straps on your arm. And then oftentimes what they would do is they would take the leather, and after it got laced on their arm, they'd stick their arm in water. And they would soak those straps so that the leather would shrink and it would tighten up even further on the arm so it couldn't spin around, it couldn't get turned. That would be bad. It had to always be facing out, facing the enemy. I always think of that when I think of claymore mines. And I'm sure nobody in here has ever seen a claymore but me. I've never been in the military. But I just think it's funny. I know it's not, but it's funny to me. A claymore is a type of a mine. It's kind of thin, and it goes around like this, about this big, and it has spikes in it. You set it in the ground, and then you put trip wires on it, and when somebody comes across it, it blows all kinds of shrapnel in them, kills a bunch of the enemy. But if you look at a claymore mine, printed on it, does anybody know what's printed on the front of it? Toward enemy. This side toward the enemy. They idiot-proofed it. Because it's designed to blow one way. It's not designed to blow back. It's designed to blow forward. I always think it's funny. It says, this side toward enemy. So, you never know what that private's going to be thinking if he's out there in the middle of the heat of combat. Might need to have that information. But the buckler was like, the buckler was not to be turned around. It was to be always facing out toward the enemy. And the buckler would be made of, usually the buckler would be made of some particular kind of metal, and then it would have this kind of metal plate, and then stuck on top of the metal plate would maybe be another piece of metal attached to it, and it may be rounded, or it may come up to a point like that. And the reason for that was that it was designed to, when he would put his arm up and a blow from a sword would come down, it would deflect the sword off one way or the other. And so it was made so that it would be able to produce a glancing blow from the enemy's sword. And so you envision the soldier yourself being knocked down to the ground. All right, you've succumbed to the sin in your members. You've been knocked down to the ground. But God says, "I'll be a buckler to you." He could put his left arm up with his buckler on it, and he'd be able to deflect the blows from his enemy with that buckler. And it was designed, the reason it was designed small, it wasn't designed to be used long. It was designed to be it just gave him enough time. That's all he needed. He just needed enough time to put his right hand down on the ground, which had his sword in it, and be able to push himself back up and retrieve his sword as he's coming up. That's all the time he needed. That's all the time the buckler would buy him. It would buy him enough time to where he could put his hand on the ground, push himself back up, and then regain his footing and get back in the fight again. And that's why it had the shape to it that it had, and why it was small enough for maneuverability. Well, when you think of all those things, you begin to realize what precision God has done and built into this, and in the terminology that he has chosen. When it matches up with us being our own worst enemy, when sin in our members has caused us to fail, to fall down, and he says, I'll be a buckler to them that walk uprightly. You'll have the means in the curriculum itself for you to be able to. Now, the opponent is your closest, constant opponent, yourself, but you'll be able to deflect those blows, get back up, and get moving again. And he's dealing with that first form of opposition, the most common form of opposition you and I face. And he uses terminology to describe close in, hand-to-hand, arm-to-arm combat that a soldier has, which illustrates the close, constant, one-on-one type battle that we would have with sin in our members, with that opposing, that opposition coming from ourselves, our own selves. And then he puts it together with the issue of them that walk uprightly. And that has to do with what we're trying to do as sons. In fact, that terminology comes right down to the ground to where you and I are as sons, walking uprightly. The issue with the soldier isn't one of walking uprightly, so to speak, as far as his manner and behavior, although physically he does. He can't fight. In fact, that's really another nuance of this. The issue is that in fighting, the soldier has to stand to fight. He has to be upright. He can't fight on his back. And they recognize that. We're losing a lot of soldiers here because they get down, they get knocked down, and they stay down, they can't get back up. Well, let's develop a system and train them with it, not just simply say, here, use this if all else fails. But there wasn't a single piece of armament that a Roman soldier ever used that he wasn't trained. There was a whole block of training that went with it, even the buckler. And the technique of how to glance the blows and push himself back up, get back up, but he's got to stand to fight. He can't be on his back. Well, the issue is that the opponent wants to get him on his back. That's exactly what sin in your members wants to do. And when he's on his back, when that soldier's on his back, he's failed in his position. And he's been knocked down. He's been overcome by his opponent. But the issue is, he doesn't have to give up. He's got this buckler. He does not have to give up. And that's the worst possible thing. You remember when Bob Howard was here, he stressed over and over again that no matter what happened on a battlefield, you had to fight no matter what. Could you fight? Blood in the eyes, shot to pieces, but you still have to fight. How are we going to get out of this mess? We're going to fight our way out of this mess. That soldier doesn't have to just give up. And that's the worst possible thing that could happen to you. Oh, I've sinned, I've done this, I've done that, I've screwed this up and muffed this up so bad, there's just no way I'm going to continue on in this sonship life. The Father says, don't ever think that. I'll be your buckler. And I'm going to provide the information so that you can get back up. The issue is the soldier doesn't have to give up when he's got that buckler. He doesn't have to just lay there, open his arms up, so to speak, let his opponent put his sword down on his throat and claim victory. Slit the throat. You don't have to do that. And that's one of the very important aspects of what this buckler is all about. He's got that buckler. He can deflect the blows. It enables him to have the time to get back up. And that's the concept. And again, what I'm teaching you today, let me give you a piece of warning. You are not being taught how to deal with sin in your life today in this Bible class. If you are, I am remiss in not telling you you're fooling yourself, because I haven't taught you any of that today. I have through Romans 8, through Romans 6, through Romans 7, through Romans 8. I've taught about it a lot. Today is more of a devotional. It's an exhortation from a proverb. And the only reason I'm warning is sometimes I get the sense that you're liking this. Or that you might think that this is real meaty stuff. This isn't meaty stuff. This is an exhortation, proverbial type exhortation. It's designed to complement the end of a massive amount of doctrine. So lest you think that this class is your end-all on dealing with sin, it's not even addressing that. It's trying to encourage you once again to remember that third probing question and match that with the exhortation that maybe will help you recognize the power that God has placed into the curriculum and takes away another excuse for you to not present your body as a living sacrifice. There is no excuse. And so, that little caveat of warning there. But I was thinking myself, this sounds almost devotional today. That's a problem. So I just wanted to make sure we didn't go away thinking this was the meat of the thing. It's not. Well, that's the concept, though, in connection with the buckler and with us walking uprightly. The soldier has the buckler, and we're to be walking uprightly. That's the position we're supposed to be in. And the closest common, most common, most powerful opponent that we will ever face is ourselves when we fail by yielding to sin in our members and its lusts that come along as we're walking uprightly. That buckler comes along and does the very thing that's described in our epistles, especially in Romans 6, Romans 7, and especially even more so in Romans 8, the first 13 verses. And when we do fail, because we stupidly yield ourselves to the lust of our flesh, our Father has given us something in the curriculum that we're supposed to think about. And something that he tells us, this is what I want you to operate upon. And it enables us to, you can almost envision Romans 8, 1 through 13 as the actual buckler. That's the mechanical means. That's the implement that I'm going to use over and over again, that when I get knocked down, I can get back up and I'm not even going to think about giving up. And when we do that, our Father tells us to operate upon it, and he enables us to, when we are knocked down and fail to continue walking uprightly, to get back up, to get back in the fight, and to go on. And that's the way in which the third probing question of Romans 8:33 matches up with the Son's exhortation to his commitment to the effectual working of what he learns in Proverbs 2:7b. So, you can take that information now about the buckler, and you should be able to say, oh yeah, I see that's an implement of war, and we're now moving into three areas, the buckler, keeping, and preserving, that have to do with a fight. And my biggest, the reason why the biggest implement of war that's mentioned there is the one in verse 7b is because that's the one you're going to be engaged with the most. And so therefore, who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? When I'm my own opponent, my Father's given me a buckler so that when I knock myself down, I can ward off the blows and get back up and carry on. And that's that doctrine that's contained in that first part of our sanctified life. And it's going to continue being there, continue through the curriculum. All right. Well, I think we'll stop it there for today and not move on. We'll move on to maybe we can cover, I don't know if we can get the next two all in one time or not. But the next one, he keepeth the paths of judgment. And as we've been tracking, that one is going to be the fourth probing question. Who is he that condemneth? And you ought to be starting to think now about what is the connection between the probing question and the godly remedy about Christ, who is even at the right hand of God and making intercession for us, and he keepeth the paths. Paths, this is key, paths, plural, of judgment. And then the last one, and preserveth the way, singular, the singular way of his saints. And that's the fifth probing question. That's the adversary. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And they match up beautifully. Because one of them has to do with a plurality of paths, and the other one has to do with a singular way. So we'll get to those beginning next time. All right, with our heads bowed.